some researchers refer to houses haunted by ghosts as hauntings, and then poltergeist events they refer to as infestations.
Ladies and gentlemen,
there's often great thumping noises on the walls of dwellings or other buildings, rappings and poundings and eerie scratchings that appear to come from inside the walls and even inside solid wooden tables, for instance. Another hallmark is stone falls. Poltergeists seem to be crazy about stones. Showers of stones that occur outside. But the weirdest thing is stone falls inside. A levitation of other objects, certainly plates, knives, forks, any number of things. As he entered the kitchen, a knife lifted up off the microwave and flew across the room straight for his chest and stopped in mid-air in front of his chest and dropped on the floor.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, Banal of America Audio with your host, Tim Banal.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another edition of BOA Audio Season 9. And tonight on the program, we have a really remarkable guest, a really remarkable topic, and a throwback in a lot of ways to the early years of Banal of America, way back in April of 2007 during BOA Audio Season 2. We had our guest tonight on the program along with his co-author, and we talked about his book covering the Yowie, Australia's Bigfoot, and it really kind of opened my eyes to the potential stuff we could do on this program. I mean, here was a marathon conversation about Australia's Bigfoot that was just compelling stuff, highly informative, a real revelatory conversation, and that was, you know, eye-opening for me. I was like, there's so many avenues we can go down with this program. And I've recommended that episode to so many people, and I was very fortunate that this past fall, I just received an email out of the blue. I think it's the trickster element there, the cosmic prankster, sent me an email, and it was Tony Healy, and he said he had a new book out with Paul titled Australian Poltergeist, and I was like, man, how has it been so long since I talked to you in the first place? I was completely blown away, and then thrilled because I was like, wait a minute, you're the Yowie guy, you've got a poltergeist book. Then I find out he's deep into the poltergeist stuff. And I was so amazed by the Yowie book and the Yowie research that him and Paul did that I just devoured this book because it's of the same quality, even deeper in a lot of ways because they, as you'll find out in this conversation, they go into a poltergeist, I don't even know what you'd call it, a poltergeist house, a house with a poltergeist, at one point. And we're going to get into all that. And I'm very excited. I love the book. It is absolutely fantastic. Australian Poltergeist, The Stone Throwing Spook of Humpty Doo and Many Other Cases. Tony Healy, welcome back to BOA Audio. It has been far too long, and I'm really looking forward to this conversation, my friend.
Oh, hello there, Tim. Yeah, look, thanks for having me back on, mate. I remember how much fun it was talking to you last time, and thanks very much for your kind comments about the new book.
Oh, man, it's absolutely amazing. What I really like about it, I got to put it over now so I don't forget, is that it's just jam-packed with cases. I mean, there's sort of like the first three quarters is really in-depth examination of cases. And then the final quarter is just this litany of amazing Australian poltergeist cases. So if you're kind of going through the book and you're like, oh, there's five, all right, whatever. By the time you're done with the book, how many total would you say are in the book? You must know that.
Yeah, I think it's 50, isn't it, or 51.
There you go. So dozens of yeah. Dozens of cases are in there.
Yeah, oh, for sure.
It's amazing stuff.
It's mind-boggling.
Yeah, spanning like over a century of Australian history. So it's absolutely jam-packed. And what I like about it is the spirit of the book in a lot of ways, too. What you say in the book, you and Paul, is that you know, you want this book to be used by future researchers and stuff like that. So you put all that you had in there, and I respect and appreciate that. You sort of had an eye toward the future, maybe distant future, with the book. So it's definitely one that belongs on everybody's bookshelf.
Oh, great. Yeah, no, thanks for that. We were hoping that it might become a bit of a source book for future researchers, be they true believers like us, or folklorists, or even militant skeptics. We don't mind. We just put all the material in there, and we say, well, as far as we're concerned, the poltergeist stuff definitely occurs because we've seen it happening. And some of our eyewitnesses are just rock solid, hundreds of them. So, as you say, it's all there. All they got to do is take the time to look at it.
Yeah, they should. They absolutely should. And I just to sort of backtrack a little bit, just to plug the Yowie book. That one's called The Yowie in Search of Australia's Bigfoot. And you've also got Out of the Shadows, Mystery Animals of Australia, which we never done a show about, but we'll have to do one definitely in the future, cause that sounds awesome. Now, it's been way too long, as I said, since we had you on the show. So bring us up to speed. Who is Tony Healy? Catch the newcomers up, you know, to your bio, your background, and then let us know about, especially I'm interested in, how did, like I said, when we first, when I first introduced you here, you know, I thought you were just a Yowie researcher, and I'm amazed. I mean, we talked for like 2 hours about Yowie like 7 years ago, and we never even got into poltergeist as far as I can recall, and all this time you were doing poltergeist stuff too. So how did all these sort of streams cross in a way? So give us all that information, the bio, the background, and how this research evolved into all the different areas.
Well, I guess it's just one of those hobbies that got completely out of control. Started off harmlessly enough. When I was about 12 years old, I read a book about the Loch Ness Monster, and I thought, oh boy, it would be great to get over there and have a look for that thing. But I couldn't imagine in those days that I'd ever get to do it, but I've been over there 4 times now on expeditions.
Oh, nice.
And visited about 45, probably getting on to, nearly 50 different lakes around the world that have similar legends and modern reports. But America's to blame partly too for my my lifestyle, because I was working in Canada in 1969-70, just up in British Columbia there, and of course I heard about the Sasquatch, and it seemed to me that some of the I was in a logging camp, and some of the fellows there, they obviously believed it, and then I realized the local Native Americans there also had a strong belief in it, and so I got the bug, and I returned to Australia and saved my money and went on a 2-year round the world monster safari.
Nice.
The big three of monsterdom were in my sights: the Bigfoot, the Loch Ness Monster, and then the Yeti in the Himalayas. But of course, as you know, Tim, there are many other cryptozoological mysteries around
absolutely.
The world. So I visited several countries on that trip, and obscure places like Andros Island in the Bahamas, looking for a kind of a medium foot, I suppose you'd call it, about a 5 foot tall lake that they talk about.
Yeah.
But anyway, that kind of got me started, and on my return from that trip, I ran into Paul Cropper, my colleague and co-author, down at Kangaroo Valley, in New South Wales, where there was a Black Panther outbreak. As you know, there's no big cats supposedly in Australia, but sheep and even horses were being killed by this great big Black Panther that people were seeing.
An ABC, right?
ABC, that's it, mate. Yeah, the old alien big cats. And I already had a slim file on the cats at that stage, because actually, just flashing back for a minute, I saw what looked like an American mountain lion in Queensland way back in 1965, but I couldn't believe my eyes at the time. I thought I must have had an hallucination, because it was just beside the road, you know, as we were driving at night.
And, yeah.
Anyway, I dismissed that. In Australia, we have the big black cats reports and sandy-coloured ones like American mountain lions. So that's another big thing. And we have water monster stories here too, a little weaker than the ones in North America and Scotland and so on.
Mm.
But, so it sort of just grew and grew. And slowly, I guess, Paul and I, well, we had an interest in, mutual interest in ghost stories. And then on one of my monster hunting journeys, I dropped in at a house at Gyra in northern New South Wales that had been the site of an infamous poltergeist episode in 1921. So that was the first poltergeist house that I'd visited. And so we started to accumulate a file. Paul got really, really skilled at digging up old colonial era cases. And then by sheer chance, bit of a long story in itself, we managed to embed ourselves, as they say in the paper these days, we got embedded in the middle of a huge poltergeist episode at a rural property at Humpty Doo in the Northern Territory in 1998.
Mm.
So that really got us going. So anyway, a brief kind of sketch of how Paul and I got into all this, I suppose you'd say.
Yeah, and then it just sort of culminated here with this book, Australian Poltergeist. It's we'll get into the Humpty Doo thing. I wanted to cut you off there because I was afraid you were going to start telling that story because I have millions of questions and really that's a stunning case. Before we get into that, let me just see here. Well, I always feel compelled, you know, we have the newcomers to the audience, we have the people who I was kind of thinking about it actually as I read this book. I was like, you know, I thought I knew a lot about poltergeists, but really I only knew what I thought I knew. I guess that might be the best way to put it, you know. I learned a lot more about what the Polt research community, let's say, knows about these things. And it's a lot more than I previously had known. So let's just give people the thumbnail, catch them up to speed for the newcomers in the audience, you know. Give us the basics on poltergeists so then we can really dig into the entire, milieu you've presented here.
Okay. Well, the term poltergeist is an old German term meaning noisy ghost, a noisy spirit, geist. Ghost, you know, spirit, and polter is knocking or noisy. And the way these things seem to differ from, shall we say, ordinary hauntings, that there's often great thumping noises on the walls of dwellings or other buildings, rappings and poundings and eerie scratchings that appear to come from inside the walls and even inside solid wooden tables, for instance. Another hallmark is stone falls. Poltergeists seem to be crazy about stones. Showers of stones that occur outside in the outdoors during daylight and at night out of a clear sky. No one can see where these things are coming from. But the weirdest thing is stone falls inside, which we experienced at Humpty Doo. The stones seeming to appear just under the ceiling and raining down. Paul got a shower of stones on his head. So you have the showers of stones, a levitation of other objects, including heavy furniture sometimes, but certainly plates, knives, forks, any number of things, buckets. We had one case where it was very much like the Sorcerer's Apprentice scene in Walt Disney's Fantasia, where the buckets and mops and brooms were dancing around in a dairy, a milking shed. Sometimes the most eerie, creepy poltergeist cases involve disembodied voices. Now, we only have one case like that in our Australian files, and we call it the creepiest case of all. We call it the Coal Baggy Bogey.
Oh, yeah.
From the 1880s, I think it was 1887 or 89, but that was a creepy one. It was very similar to the infamous Bell Witch case in America in the 1830s. And another amazing case called the Gag Poltergeist from Canada, Eastern Canada, Quebec, I think. Some researchers say, look, there's no real dividing line between poltergeists and ordinary hauntings. Ordinary hauntings involve the sighting of a foggy figure of a person, sometimes translucent, sometimes fairly solid, phantom footsteps, rattling of chains.
all that good.
But
ghost stuff.
But the poltergeist is essentially objects flying around. But the thing is that we've noticed in the Australian cases and other people overseas have been into these things for years have noticed that sometimes poltergeist cases can sort of transform over a few years or a few months into a more like a conventional haunting.
Right.
And vice versa. Sometimes a conventional haunting can become more and more violent and end up like a poltergeist case. So
right.
I hope that's, more or less enough info for you.
Yeah, that's the gist of it. Seems like the critical part of the whole poltergeist thing is this kineticness of it all. The kinesis, the things are moving around. Whether we don't know exactly how they're moving around, but it's that's the critical part. Things are moving and things are, it just seems to revolve around objects a lot most of the time. It's very, that's the intriguing part of it all. And it's when you really think about it, it's like I see the argument of the. Of some of the people in the community or whatever you want to call it, but I feel like the poltergeist have to kind of stand alone, separate from ghosts, because by its very nature, by its very name, it's a specific thing. Do you know what I mean?
Well, I guess you'd have to say, by its very name, as you said, it's a poltergeist and not just an ordinary geist.
Exactly. Right.
Type of haunting. Yeah. Some researchers refer to houses haunted by ghosts as hauntings, and then poltergeist events they refer to as infestations.
Wow.
Which just sounds pretty sinister, and they can be certainly sinister. It's like they infest a house.
That makes sense now, actually, because I've heard stories and people say things like, about infested houses, and when you hear the story, you're like, wait, that's just a poltergeist. So, yeah, it makes sense. Like I was going to say, sort of to follow up on the point about how it kind of stands alone, just the fact that it over time has sort of solidified into the name poltergeist. You know what I mean? It's not just like some throwaway thing. It just kept repeatability factor sort of comes into play here, and you're like, okay, clearly history has shown us that this is some kind of thing. So this is, for the people that's like, oh, it's not real or whatever. It's definitely real. Whatever it is, we don't know exactly what causes it, but it's definitely like something that happens.
Yeah.
Otherwise, it wouldn't still be around after all these years.
That's true, Tim, yeah. Yeah, the sounds have been recorded on several occasions and analysed, and the results are quite interesting. Printouts from the sound recordings are proved to be very different from ordinary rappings. If you bash a wall and record yourself and record the sound, the printout comes out in a certain form, but the poltergeist sounds are radically different. I'm not technical enough to just recall off the top of my head.
Yeah, yeah.
They are different, but we summarise these findings in the book.
Something involving the rods and cones.
Yeah. Of course, one of the other classic hallmarks of many poltergeist cases is that there often seems to be a adolescent child at the epicenter of all the poltergeist attention.
Usually
a girl, sometimes a boy. Sometimes it's not an adolescent. It might be a troubled adult or just a seemingly ordinary adult, but for some reason the poltergeist concentrates on this person. There's all kinds of theories, unprovable, I suppose. There's theories that these people are natural mediums, that they're very psychic. They may be aware of it and they may not be aware of it. They're usually very frightened, of course, by what's happening, and they wish it didn't happen. A lot of poltergeist researchers and casual observers say, oh, well, either these kids are faking it somehow, which is totally unbelievable, I think, in many of our cases, or that those troubled individuals are somehow moving the objects themselves unwittingly via psychokinesis or telekinesis, you know, mind over matter. They get all hung up about the school exams or something, and then suddenly chairs fly across the room.
Yeah, exactly.
You can make a good argument for it, except that in many cases there is no adolescent child at the epicenter, and some of the cases don't focus exclusively on one particular person. They, in as you would have noticed in our second case there, the Mayanup poltergeist from Western Australia, that's our strongest case by far, even better than the Humpty Doo case, that poltergeist or poltergeists started by focusing on an Aboriginal family that was working on a huge grazing property, and then hooked on to some of their relations that came to visit to comfort them. And then it was operating on two different properties. Then it followed some other people to a third property 150 kilometres away, and it was going like hell for leather on three of these properties.
Yeah.
And then it stopped on the farthest property and began on a fourth property to the south of the two original ones. So it wasn't, as you can see, it wasn't focused on one particular person, at least not exclusively. And that case went on for many years. In fact, it's still going in a weaker and modified form even today. So.
You mentioned, you bring up the other sort of pillar of the poltergeist, and that's the sort of the suspicion, let's say, of that there's some kind of disaffected youth at the center of it. It's kind of remarkable, too, as reading the book, it's like people, it's like that idea is so stuck in people's heads now, too, that they immediately go to blame people. Do you know what I mean? It's unfortunate in a lot of ways, because in modern times, this kind of thing happens in a house or something, because people think that, they immediately are like, it's your teenage daughter, man, she's all crazy, and that may not necessarily be it. It's kind of scary. It's like the witch trials, kind of.
Yes, that's right. Certainly in some of our cases, and many overseas cases, the local authorities have grilled the person that seems to be the focus, some poor, unfortunate kid. They've given the kid the third degree and demanded that they confess that they've hoaxed everything. The kid has another breakdown, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
it's crazy. It's really
weird.
Yeah, just the human element of the phenomenon is bizarre like that. And the other part that was interesting that kind of wanted to bring up from what you were just saying is, like, to your credit, you guys do publish some cases that turned out to be hoaxes in the book, and I appreciate that and respect that. So that's awesome that you guys do that. But then when you look at the more fantastic cases, it's like, I just scoff at these skeptics and the non-believers and that something's happening here, because they think that someone could hoax this stuff. The sheer logistics of it just make it impossible for someone to hoax this stuff. It's just, and if they actually did the research or like read the stuff or looked at it or really, I guess it's the believability thing, you know, they just can't believe it. But it's like, if these plates are flying out of a cabinet, you know, in perfect formation, you know, this teenage kid's doing this, they should be doing better things than that. Like, you know, they should be getting in trouble with these abilities, not making plates fly out. But that's the thing. It's like there's no way that this is just some prankster doing this stuff. Or human prankster, let's say.
Yeah, a kid like that could put David Copperfield to shame, you know, one of these stage magicians. But another thing too is, as we've said in the book, you know, even if a skeptical reader, a stubbornly skeptical reader, just cannot believe the Australian stuff, you know, we've recommended that they look at, Nandor Fedora's book, The Poltergeist Through the Ages, that he wrote in the 1950s, or compiled in the 1950s, where he and Harold Carrington collected over 300 reports, dating from as early as 300 AD. And, it's just all these hallmarks of poltergeist activity just occur and occur and occur in different cultures, in different centuries,
yeah.
I mean, in the case of Australia, you know, over the course of 150 years, they've been occurring in different parts of the country to people who couldn't, you know, feasibly have known how to fake a poltergeist event. You know, they wouldn't know enough about the phenomenon to fake it. Yet their cases follow the same pattern as age-old cases from overseas and elsewhere in Australia.
It should be mentioned, too. It's like these people, they don't have the time or the inclination to hoax a poltergeist case in their home. It's like they're barely eking out a living or they're barely scraping by. These are like territorial type situations, folks. You know, that's the crazy part.
Yeah.
Like, they're trying to survive. They don't have time to make up poltergeist stories. Like, they don't. So, you know what I mean?
That's right, yeah. Yeah, that's right. Some of those colonial-era people in the book, yeah, they, it must have been a great nuisance, and some of them actually they packed up and left the place, you know, they moved.
Right.
But, certainly in Humpty Doo, people who were in the house, the occupants of the house that was being persecuted, by the time we got there, they were totally and utterly sick of the whole thing. Now, they were, as they say up there, they'd had a gutful of it. And they said, we just want to get rid of the effing thing. You know?
Yeah, exactly. Let's do Humpty Doo, because that's a big, big, big part of the book. And as I said, yeah, I think, you know, I've had a lot of people on talking about all kinds of stuff on this show, but you're definitely the first guy I've ever talked to who's been inside of a poltergeist-infested house. Perspective sounds absolutely amazing. So I guess first, and I know it's a huge story and it's a huge part of the book, so we just want to give a thumbnail for people on this story. Give them, you know, catch them up a little bit, you know, but they got to pick up the book because it's like 60 pages plus in the book. It's absolutely amazing, folks, and totally captivating, but we can't really talk about it unless we tell you a little bit about it.
Sure.
Catch them up on that.
Yeah. Well, I'll try and keep it brief, but as you may have noticed, the big problem with me is there's so much to tell, I get excited about it and tend to ramble on, but the Humpty Doo business started in January 1998. It's in the tropics up near Darwin, and it's a very, very stormy season. They call it the wet up there in January, December, January, February, lightning and so on. Now, many of our poltergeist cases are associated with stormy weather, rainy periods. Other people have noted that overseas too. Electrical activity seems to be a part of it somehow. We don't know how. But these people were sitting outside on their veranda or outside in the yard and watching the lightning. And stones started to flick out of the shadows or out of the sky or something. And they thought somehow some of their friends or whatever had come onto the property, which is reasonably remote, and a long way off the, 70 metres off a remote road. They thought that's strange, and they went searching around the 5-acre property looking, couldn't see anything, went inside, and the stones followed them inside, started raining inside. And they thought, well, they couldn't think what to do, so they opened the manhole in the ceiling to see if there was something in the loft of the building. But as soon as they opened the manhole, a rain of stones came down on their faces. Then there was scratchings and bangings, and objects started flying around. It was quite violent in those days. It smashed CD players and windows, glass panels in cases.
Yeah, lots of glass. Really, I noticed that lots of glass flying around. That was the troubling part.
Yes, yes.
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Yeah, it would, even when we were there, it was still dropping shards of broken glass. Well, I don't know where it got that from, because, you know, the glass had all been cleaned up. All the broken windows were fixed by the time we got there, but it was still raining broken glass.
Jesus, yeah.
But anyway, to cut a long story short, they thought, what do we do? What do we do? You know, when you've got a... Well, they realized it was a poltergeist, you know, they knew that,
yeah,
they'd seen the movies, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
So they thought, well, who do you call? And so they weren't religious at all, so but they called the local Catholic priest. And in the end, the three priests attended over different periods of time, and the local priest was there several times. But that just seemed to aggravate things. And the priest from Darwin was an Indian fellow who was there on exchange, and he said he'd seen several infestations in India, and he said, look, I'll bless the place, but it probably won't work. It doesn't seem to work, but I'll try it. And as he entered the kitchen, a knife lifted up off the microwave and flew across the room straight for his chest. But he just stood there, yeah. He said, well, I didn't have time to move anyway, but I knew it wouldn't hurt me. And it stopped in midair just in front of his chest and dropped on the floor.
Hmm.
So he said to them, well, look, you just got to wait for these things to finish, and probably will, unless it's focused on one of you who may be a natural medium. Well, it did finish when they all finally left the house. It didn't follow them. So I think it might have been something to do with the sight, well, amongst other things, which I could mention later. But anyway, the phenomena was pretty intense. It was many, many rains of stones indoors and out, lots of knives flying around, banging and crashing. The crucifix that one of the priests left became a frequent flyer, as they called it. Several objects that the people in the house referred to as frequent flyers, and the crucifix flew around. The Bible was thrown around and smashed against the wall so much that it just about fell apart. One of the priests, a Greek Orthodox guy, when he was trying to do his thing, something grabbed his right arm and twisted it up behind his back.
Oh, my God.
And he just about had a heart attack. He said, oh, this is the worst one I've ever struck. So it went on and on and on, and there were a local newspaper heard about it after about a month, and all the journalists, or two or three young journalists from there, plus the editor, all saw they got hit by stone falls and everything. They wrote it up. And then, of course, the World Press got going on it, and a television station, television program in Australia here, a tabloid television show, really, called Today Tonight, offered them, what was it, $2,000, something, I think out of the figure, it wasn't much between the five of them anyway, for exclusive rights to the, exclusive access to the house for a week. And they said, yeah, mainly to get the other media off their backs, because they were being fielding phone calls from all over the world at one stage. Anyway, the television people set up many, many cameras inside and out, and they found, as we did with our cameras later, that nothing happened in front of the cameras, but plenty happened just out of range of the cameras and just behind the cameras. They went away, and we arrived shortly after that. And as I said, we were there for 5 days, and the people were pretty hospitable, although they were very tired and jumpy by then.
Yeah, yeah.
So we saw plenty of objects flying. I saw an object just materialize out of thin air right in front of me. So it didn't take much to convince us that it was real.
Right, right. It's amazing stuff. Like, what? I guess give me a little bit on the personal perspective of like being there. I think you mentioned in the book I think you said like it was cool when you were visiting, but then you spent the night, and that's when you were the first time you were kind of like, uh-oh. I don't know if I like this poltergeist research anymore. But like, what was it like being there? Did the hair on your neck stand up when this stuff happened? Like, were you like, how did it feel?
Well, it was really exciting more than scary. Mm. We were laughing, you know, because the days up there are pretty long, you know, in the summer, and mm-hmm. There was plenty of light, and we were there until, you know, late in the evening, but by that time most of the people were home from their various jobs, so it wasn't like we were alone in the haunted house, you know, scenario.
Right.
But it was definitely creepy. I found that if I left the group and went down to the far end of the house into what everyone agreed seemed to be the creepiest feeling room, I was a bit jumpy there. And there was only one night that Paul and I slept there. We put out our sleeping bags on the floor in the lounge room, and that was kind of creepy. That was actually the first night we were there.
Oh, geez.
So we didn't know what to expect. There's a lot of being the tropics, there's a lot of funny noises, you know, things whooping and creaking and gibbering, you know, geckos and things. And, of course, I think I'm a bit jumpier than Paul. I just got jumped up and clung to the ceiling like a couple of times, but, so that was a little unnerving, but generally, no, it wasn't scary to us. And the householders had actually got sort of so used to it, although they were tired of it, that it didn't scare them anymore. They said the first night that it happened, well, the ladies particularly were crying. They were really scared because it sounded like something big and menacing with claws was like inside the internal walls right next to their beds, clawing and scurrying and so on, as well as objects flying all around the place. And I should mention, perhaps for the benefit of the listeners, that just 2 weeks before this business began, a good friend of all of the people in the house, a guy called Troy Redatz, was incinerated in a terrible road accident just a kilometre away. He and a friend had been driving along in a car, and they had the back of the truck was full of paint thinner, and they were incinerated. So when it first began, they thought, could it have been him trying to communicate with them or whatever?
Yeah.
And this got, this theory grew when his name was spelled out. This weird graffiti started appearing in the house, sometimes scrawled on the walls and doors with what you call the magic markers, and sometimes spelled out bizarrely in pebbles, hundreds of pebbles arranged incredibly neatly into the form of letters like a Troy, a car, burn, well, and help, I think was another one. Pretty clearly, either it was Troy, their friend, sort of saying, well, it was me, or as they, the people there came to suspect the poltergeist had been eavesdropping on their conversations and was trying to mess with their minds, maliciously sort of playing on their grief about friend. And they challenged it after a while. They said, they walked through the house loudly swearing and saying, "You're not Troy, you know, blankety blank."
Yeah, such and such.
Swear words. "You're not Troy, you know, why don't you just piss off, you know, get lost, go away." And the graffiti continued, but the references to Troy ceased. Nevertheless, I think that it's possible that Troy's death, that somehow or other his spirit was part of this thing. But there were so many other, there are four or five other ingredients to this haunting. So I think Troy's death was just one of them. It was like a sort of, it had the makings of a psychic stew when you broke it down, this haunting. Should I go into that, Tim?
I think you're thinking about, you're alluding to the Aboriginal strangeness that happened there. So tell me about that, because in reading that, it really struck me as, like, bizarre. It's like you said, it's really this, like, psychic stew, and this was, like, a really strange potato that kind of floated up in this story, and I was like, what is going on with this Aboriginal element to this whole thing? So talk about that, because it was really bizarre.
For sure, four days before Paul and I arrived at the house, the poltergeist stuff had been going full strength, all the stone falls, etc. And then one day, Kirsty Argyas, the lady who was the only person who stayed at home there during the day, she was the only one who didn't work because she had a 11-month-old daughter. So she was there by herself, and she said she just looked out the kitchen window, and there were two very dark Aboriginal guys, like full-on, you know, tribal Aboriginal fellows, right outside the kitchen, kneeling down, digging a hole underneath a mango tree. And she said, she went out and said, "What are you doing here?" And they stood up. They didn't even look at her. They walked around the house and then up this 70-meter driveway to the road, and there was a little orange car up there. They got in and drove away. Well, they'd cleared a patch of leaves about grave-sized, about 6 feet by 2 feet, and in the top center of it there was this hole that they were digging. It was still there when we got there. Well, after that, as soon as they left, all the phenomena stopped for 4 days, and we got there, and they said, "Well, you're welcome to the house, but nothing's happened for 4 days." And we thought, "Oh my God, no! The cosmic prankster is playing a trick on us here. We've come all the way from nearly 2,500 kilometres from the south of Australia up to Darwin, and the poltergeist has decided to waltz off into the ether and cease activity." So we hung around. We went and investigated another mystery, which was up the road for a couple of days, and I'll tell more about that later, perhaps. And that's right. There was 4 days before we got there, there was nothing. Then for the first day we were there, there was nothing. And then it started again, too much to our relief. So that was the Aboriginal thing. There's a bit of a mystery because I don't think it's unfair to say that those five people in the house, they were working class people, they worked hard and so on. but they were racist, really, predominantly, a bit racist, somewhat racist, you might say.
Culturally racist might be a good way to put it. They were culturally racist. Of that socioeconomic class where racism is prevalent.
There's a class thing. Well, see, the Northern Territory was one of the more recent frontiers of Australia. There were still massacres happening up there in the late 1920s and people being speared and shot and so on. Mm. The Aboriginal people up there are some of them very, very tribal. They've still got all their culture and, they get their own way and working 9 to 5 is in many cases not part of the scenario. So some white working class guys, although they're getting paid well and everything, they have this kind of, attitude, the Aborigines won't do any work. We got to do it all. But of course, they should be grateful to have a job. Anyway, whatever. The husband of this woman who saw the Aborigines, he said, look, I think this somehow might be connected with something that happened a couple of years ago at a previous house that he and his wife had been in. There had been stones that flew in through the front door in the most mysterious manner. Never made a mark on the walls, which is very strange. That's another poltergeist hallmark.
Right.
And at that time, he thought it must have been Aboriginal kids with slingshots, because he said, oh, they probably heard me saying something down at the pub about how I don't like Aborigines or something.
Hmm.
Anyway, whatever it was dead strange. I mean, either those two Aborigines were trying to lift the curse. He thought maybe some Aboriginal medicine man, a wizard or shaman, had somehow put a bit of a curse on him and his wife. But whether these Aborigines were trying to lift that curse or re-energize it somehow is one of the mysteries of the thing.
Yeah. I tend to think that they had heard about the whole thing from all the media attention and maybe went to try and help out. That was my first. That's kind of my inclination.
Yeah, they may have. Yeah.
But they didn't. Since they didn't say anything, makes it weirder.
Yeah, because after all, the stuff did stop for 4 days. Perhaps if you hadn't interrupted them, it would have stopped altogether.
Right. Exactly. Yeah.
And in one of our other cases, that Mayanup case from Western Australia, there's a lot of Aboriginal input into that. There were three Aboriginal shamans who were asked to try and exorcise the poltergeist again with mixed success. One guy seems to have had some success and the other two just aggravated it as the Catholic priest did.
Yeah.
But in the Northern Territory, at Humpty Doo, there were many other things. There was Troy Radatz's terrible death. There was the Aboriginal thing. There was the factor in that a Greek man who had built the house and established the property had it wrenched away from him by a bank. His business had failed, and he'd lost the house, and his wife and he said, we dream about it every night in our dreams. We must get back there. We will get back there. And he thought the poltergeist was a result of what had happened to him and his wife. His language was just highly charged. He said, the bank took 30 years of my blood, he said.
Oh, my goodness.
And
you're right. This is like a psychic stew here. There's all kinds of energy here.
Yeah.
And you should mention, how angry that I think it was the guy you said who made the comments in the bar, but there was one dude in the story. I forget his name. I want to say Bruce or something like that, but he was like
Murph.
Murph, yeah. It's like angry, like frightening guy. Just reading the story alone, I'm just like, I would not want to run across this guy because he seems like a real menace to society. So he seemed like trouble.
He was, he was the only single guy in the house. There were two young couples and then Murph. And Murph had been a close friend of Troy who died. He was probably the closest friend. And he seemed to be... He was a man of very few words, and he seemed to be grieving, I would say. He was very angry. He was very sensitive to any suggestion that, they'd been hoaxing it. He would get really angry. And, appropriately enough, his friend was incinerated, as I said, while Murph had, tattoos of flames all over his arms. And I thought, well, that's a pretty weird coincidence. Anyway, Murph, when we first arrived, I thought Murph might have attacked us. You know, he was swearing at us, you know, saying, oh, you, you know, the bloody journalists, media people. And we kept saying, oh, we're not media people. we're just interested. And fortunately, we had our... Poltergeist file containing all kinds of similar cases from the colonial era, and we showed it to the guys, and they could see then we were interested, and they said yeah this is exactly what's happening here, it's just what they've been trying to tell these idiots.
Yeah, exactly. You guys got some street cred there with that stuff.
Yeah.
Murph, he seemed like a really like a frightening dude. Now the other part. To compound his anger and everything, it bears mentioning the hit on that happened to these guys from the media, from that Today Tonight show. That was like a whole interior saga to this story, where it's like, oh man, they kind of got raked over the coals. They got made to look like jerks by the national TV. It's awful.
The entire team of cameramen and the director. Who had been at the house for a week, they were all totally convinced the phenomenon was real. They'd all seen rains of stones, knives, bullets, the works, as we did. They were totally convinced that but they couldn't get anything properly on camera. They just got one little bit of footage of a bullet in the last stages of its fall to the floor, plus a plastic pot that... just fell off the microwave. Nothing dramatic at all. Oh, except they did have the sense to bring with them a fellow from Queensland who had infrared cameras.
Let me just jump in here because this is absolutely.
Yeah.
I thought. One of the most amazing parts of the whole book, because I had never thought of this, and it reveals so much about what's going on, I think. It really is. I feel like it's something that it could be a doorway to much more realization of what's going on here, what this guy was doing with the photographs. I'm surprised they're not seeing more in this realm. But talk about this thermal imaging, this infrared imaging that was being done on the objects being thrown around.
The fellow's name was Brendan Gowdy, and he had very sophisticated thermal imaging cameras. One thing about poltergeist events is the stones and other objects that are thrown are often said to be very warm, even hot, even very hot to the touch. In the Northern Territory, the stones and other objects were distinctly warm. The director of this group brought along Brendan Gowdy, and they picked up some of these objects themselves, handled them, threw them, and then photographed the objects. And thermal imaging camera showed fingerprints and smudges corresponding with fingers on these objects. Whenever he photographed an object that had been apparently thrown by the poltergeist, the entire object was uniformly warm. So they were quite different.
Mm.
And so we have photographs in our book of a bullet cartridge and a shard of glass.
Yeah, it's amazing.
You know, glowing there. But so that's a good empirical evidence, I think, really.
Absolutely, that's what excited me so much about it. It's like with today's modern technology, if we had a Humpty Doo situation in 2015, maybe we could get more information by following that route of analyzing this stuff as soon as it's been thrown around. So maybe get more information.
Yeah.
But so that excited me. If anyone in the audience or if you know anything more about people who are doing this kind of stuff, that would be great. We need more of that. But I realize I interrupted you about how the media completely screwed these guys. So let's get back to that.
Yeah. It was the better part of a week. This show is a nightly. It's shown nightly in Australia. So initially, the program was sympathetic to the, you know, to the people in the house, and it was pitched. They were saying, "Well, there seems to be a genuine event." They played footage of interviews with the priests and with the local newspaper people and lots of other people, 18 people who had witnessed the events. Nobody who went to the house, by the way, ever left unconvinced. So they had these 18 people, and they had the cameras in the house. They interviewed the people. They had the cameras set up so that they covered the entire house apart from the bathroom and the bedrooms. They covered the outside of the house and everything. So they said that they were attempting to keep an eye on the people just to make sure there was no hoaxing, and as well as to try and capture the objects that were flying. And as I said, most of the time during the day it was only the one lady and the toddler there anyway from the group. But at the end of the week, they went back to Sydney, and the director said to the producer down there, "Well, you know, we've got some things on camera, and we're all convinced. We've all seen these things, and it's genuine." And the producer went through 100 hours of film, and he said, "Well, you haven't proved anything, mate. You know, there's nothing here that would convince a skeptical viewer. I mean, apart from the testimony of the eyewitnesses, there was nothing, you know, in the footage of the pistol." He said someone could have thrown that pistol cartridge and so on. Now, why the thermal imaging photos didn't cut any ice with the producer, I just don't know. Perhaps that would have been too difficult to explain on television, that kind of program. But in any case, the higher-ups above this producer said, this is a turkey. This show's a turkey. That's right. There was a one bit of footage taken after the main party left. They had a local camera team from Darwin also assisting them, and they caught an object, a pot lid, in flight. And both of those cameramen were convinced that nobody could have thrown it. But down in Sydney, an editor saw an image, a reflection of Kirsty, the woman with the toddler, in the front of a glass cabinet, so that it appeared that she was behind the cameraman, and she either looked up or bobbed up just as the object flew. Well, the cameraman said no, she was in a position where she couldn't have thrown it, and the trajectory of the thing was wrong. It must have flown, must have been a poltergeist. But down in Sydney, the bosses of the show said, "Ha ha, we've caught the hoaxer. End of story." And the woman, they insisted that the poor young director, who was a total believer, had seen all this. They insisted that he he become a hoax buster now and phone the woman from Sydney and demand that she confess. And he phoned her several times up until midnight one night, and he claimed later that she did confess. Well, when we got there, she said she did no such thing. She said the nearest thing to a confession she might have said was, say what you like, I don't care, I'm sick of the whole thing. In any case, the final program of that Today Tonight television show concluded with, well, it was a hoax, these people are, just a bunch of beer-drinking territorians and joke over,
yeah.
They're not fooled sort of thing. But it was infuriating to the people in the house because, after all, the phenomenon continued for a month, apart from that four-day hiatus after the Aboriginal visit. So it was still going on, and they were sick to death of it. It continued until they left the house about a month after we were there. And we've checked with them since. It didn't follow any of them away, so that was a relief. But there could have been something about the site itself. As, I mean, well, there was the Greek curse. Oh, by the way, that Greek man said that I don't know whether there's a curse on the house, but he said there's definitely a curse on the bank. Because when his wife was dragged out of the house, she put a Greek curse, as he calls it, on the bank. And as Paul and I say in the book, well, if every time someone cursed a bank, a poltergeist appeared, they'd be everywhere.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. That's for
anyway,
sure.
There were other things. What else was there? There was some other aspect. People had suggested that, a strange phenomenon, but much less marked, had occurred at that property before, a year or two before, so might have been something.
I think this was like 1998. Has anything, have you kind of followed up on the site since and seen if whoever lives there now is experiencing
it? I went back there, but there wasn't anyone home. The house had been, had actually been added to. It was a single story when we were there, but someone had put an added couple of rooms up top. We were told that, by a person who lived nearby, people had a lot of trouble renting the house afterwards.
Yeah.
And eventually it was given to the Defence Housing Association on a long lease, so that there was an army officer and his wife there. Our friend spoke to the wife, and the wife said that there'd been a couple of little strange little things happening, but nothing world-shattering, so hopeful it wouldn't occur.
Yeah, interesting. Makes you wonder, like, if the military owns it now, they're just like, shut up and don't tell anybody if anything happened, We wouldn't know if they keep cycling people out of it and stuff. That's just an amazing, amazing story. There's so many elements to it that are just absolutely remarkable.
Yeah.
The fact that you were there is, like, tremendous stuff.
Oh, yeah.
You got a light, buddy?
Yeah, sure, kid. There you go.
And your wallet.
Nick, give him your wallet.
What for?
He's got a knife.
A knife?
You're listening to Banal of America Audio.
That's a knife.